You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
It is your daily 10-minute business and finance news wrap for this Tuesday, the 6th of May, on a day where the share market was pretty steady. The S&P ASX 200 down just 0.1%. Plenty to talk about, though, and we'll do that with Bruce Apted from State Street Global Advisors in a few moments. But first, do you recognise this? Well, that is the ringtone of Skype, but it's going to ringtone heaven because Microsoft has killed it after 22 years. That makes it older than other video calling platforms like WhatsApp, Zoom, and FaceTime. So to tell us more and what is its legacy, Angelica White spoke with technology analyst Trevor Long.
Don't change the game with communication. There had already been some kind of internet telephone call apps. We're talking back in the 90s into the 2000s, which allowed us to do things we couldn't have imagined, you know, calling people for free, essentially, using the internet anywhere in the world. And then we had this video concept. And remember, this was science fiction, that you could see someone at the other end. So just the idea of having a video call changed the game. In fact, changed the internet forever.
And initially, what did people use Skype for?
Initially, Skype was really person-to-person, friend-to-friend, but I think it very quickly became a professional tool as well for business people that traveled and then businesses that wanted to connect remote sites. This, again, was before we had professional video systems that a lot of corporates now install in their businesses. This was open a laptop, use Skype and connect with your colleagues. But I think over time it had that transition from personal video through to business-based, and that's partly the reason for its demise.
Why is that the case? Why did it kind of lose out to competitors? What were some of the problems with Skype?
Skype was iconic for video calling, but then came along the smartphone. Apple created not just the iPhone, but then FaceTime quickly after. And this idea of sci-fi style video calling in your hand was a game changer. And then app after app after app created the same technology. WhatsApp is a good example. There's been so many of them over the years, used by travelers, used by cultural groups to connect with each other. You know, you would come across some communities, some cultures that used a particular app just because it was popular in their homeland. And so the wide number of these apps really fed the demise of Skype in the personal communication space. And that's always going to be a challenge because in the business space, there was growing numbers of new tools.
And was there anything specifically about Skype that meant that it couldn't transfer onto that kind of more, like, you know, onto a smartphone and like other apps? Why did it not move into that space?
Skype had apps. You could use Skype on your phone, but it wasn't default installed on the phone. And Apple made it easy to just do it by default in their phones, and then Google followed suit. But in reality, the real demise of Skype is probably linked to the fact that it was owned by Microsoft. So Microsoft purchased Skype, and they made it a product. They integrated it into their ecosystem. But when COVID hit, Zoom took over. Zoom became the way we communicated, the way we connected. And Microsoft hit a panic button and said, hang on, if Zoom takes over, we won't own the corporate market. And so they had to elevate their Teams product, which was their video product in businesses. And they elevated that product. They put everything into that product. And they've had to make the difficult decision to say, we can only have one product. And Teams has won that race at Microsoft. So you could say Zoom killed Skype. You could say Apple killed Skype. But in the end, Microsoft made the decision to kill Skype by backing Teams over Skype.
What do you think's next for this kind of for video communication technologies? What are we looking at in future years?
I think video hasn't reached its peak, but it's certainly plateaued to a point now where now businesses and individuals have their chosen way of doing video. If you want a video call me, it's probably going to be WhatsApp. If you want a video call, some businesses, they're just all in on one of the products, whether it's Zoom or Teams. So we've kind of plateaued in that sense. We're getting advances in the camera technology. We're getting advances in the ability to create virtual scenes and all those kind of things. But really, it's going to be a question of how AI evolves and whether or not we actually start having video calls with AI, an AI human. Are we going to have six people in a Zoom call, for example, and one of them is an AI who's doing the transcript or the action notes for the meeting? Those are the things. It's all about making our lives easier. So I think that in a corporate sense, having an AI that will summarize meetings and do action points, huge game changer that will come and is already happening. On a personal level, it's probably peaked, if not certainly plateaued, in the way that we'll use video.
It's Trevor Long there, technology commentator.
Now, Market Day on the SBS On The Money podcast.
Okay, let's take a look at the share market today, which closed pretty steady. The S&P ASX 200 down 0.1% to 8,151. It's a second day of falls, but don't forget the market did have a stellar run in the lead up, seven consecutive sessions of gains. It means over the last 2 weeks, the market is up 4.3%. So to tell us what next for shares, I spoke with Bruce Apted from State Street Global Advisors. Bruce, so it appears the ASX is pretty quiet in the lead up to the Fed decision in a few days out of the US. It follows, though, a pretty remarkable run on the ASX 200 over the past 2 weeks. How are investors feeling at the moment?
Yeah, I feel like that's a little bit of an understatement, the remarkable run that we've had. It has been truly exceptional, hasn't it? I think it's been breaking some records in terms of number of days consecutively up. And I think, I think the investors that we're speaking to anyway feel like they've had a bit of a get out of jail free card. And I think that there's genuine relief that their portfolio values are much higher now, back to sort of near where they were before. But at the same time, I think they're a little bit nervous. And I think there's kind of good reason for that when you sort of dig into where we are and how we got here and what it looks like from that point. So maybe just briefly, when we look at the relief rally we had from those negotiations, when we had the walking back from those extreme tariff positions to more of a, we're going to do deals, we're going to do negotiations, that obviously was a huge relief valve for the market. And we did see that extreme rally. But now I think people are actually saying, well, how long are these negotiations going to take? And how much more uncertainty will we see around these negotiations? Because some of them are easier and some of them are harder. So that's where it gets more complex. I think the other thing that's supported the market as well has been US earnings season. So we've had, let's say, roughly 70% of companies kind of report as of yesterday. And most of the results on the whole have been okay. Offsetting that, I think, is that sort of a realization that in many instances, we haven't really seen the full impact of these tariffs yet either. So there's still potentially more to come down the pipe in terms of what the impact might be on earnings. And we have seen a few companies pull guidance as well. That sort of just goes with that uncertainty as well. So that's I think, part of the potential picture on a forward-looking basis, which I think will make investors feel a little bit nervous, quite rightly.
You mentioned those US companies. I think we're in what we typically call confession season two in Australia as well. What are Australian companies saying about the impact of US tariffs and how their flow-on effects will impact them?
Yeah, so Australia's a bit of a different beast, really, I think for a few reasons. We haven't seen a lot of public commentary from companies in terms of how it's going to impact their earnings. I think there's probably a few reasons for that. One is that obviously as a country, Australia is not as impacted as many other countries are. So we have our baseline 10% and then we've got our 25% on steel and aluminium. They're not nothing, but they're not as huge impact in terms of the Australian economy, especially in terms of the Australian market and the market cap and big weights in the market. Obviously, just yesterday we had the extra one thrown out there. In terms of the 100% tariffs on the film production outside of the US, once again, we still don't really know how real that is. I mean, it's just it's a bit of a statement from the administration, but it could be a negotiation tactic, for example, like for many of these things. But in terms of where the Australian market is impacted, we've had a few comments from around corporate travel. They're saying, people aren't traveling as much. But we really haven't seen too many sort of first-order impacts from the tariffs from companies yet. So in my mind, I think Australia gets impacted on the second order, a second round of impacts, indirect impacts. So if we do see more of a slowdown in growth, we do see some inflationary impacts globally, then I think that's how we'll see it permeate through Australian corporate through Australian corporates.
I think we heard from the Future Fund today, right, saying that returns are above target mandates. The interesting thing is the Future Fund, though, a third of its investments are in international equities, right? How do you feel about global equities at the moment in this environment?
Yeah, so very similar. I mean, the truth is that Australian equities and global equities are completely very linked, right, in terms of the major moves. We can have slight variations for periods of time, but in terms of most of the volatility and most of the year-to-year moves, they're highly linked. So what happens in overseas markets is critical to understanding what's going to happen in Australia and what's going to happen for investors in Australia. Essentially, in terms of the outlook for global markets is, I think also quite, there's plenty of reasons for caution because there is still a lot of uncertainty to come through in terms of how these tariffs will manifest themselves or how these deals will be negotiated and how that will play out. And I think you would have heard other commentators saying this, and in fact, probably some corporates saying this as well, but essentially it's the lack of clarity as to what the path forward looks like that makes decision-making difficult. And if you can't make decisions, then things just start to seize up. And so that's the biggest risk, I think, that really there's the tariff implications on it just on the first level, but really the not knowing is a really hard thing for corporates to work with. It's hard for boards to make decisions. So that's probably the real problem, I think. And then with coupled with that, we're back at valuation levels where we were last, before all this started, and they weren't cheap across the board. Obviously, some pockets are more expensive than others, but broadly speaking, the market is still sort of sitting around MSCI World, sitting around like an 86th percentile on a PE basis, so it's still pretty expensive. So that I think bodes for being thoughtful about allocations and how you think about your portfolio.
So with all of that in mind, what are you telling your clients at the moment, and are there still any opportunities for investors in this environment?
Yeah, I might have sounded a little bit sanguine. I think there's always great opportunities, so that's definitely true. But in terms of the tried and tested truths for clients is really diversification is the biggest one. And I think people say that as a throwaway line, but it is very powerful. And really, you see it play out in what we saw in April. Even within equities, you can have parts of the equity, you can have clusters of equities that actually do well. We saw some defensive type products, some low volatility type products actually produce positive returns when the market's down. So that is what we consider the diversification. And it's actually something that goes up when something else goes down is very powerful because it actually gives you optionality and flexibility to then move to where that opportunity has been created. So you can rotate some of your assets around as things move. So diversification is a big one. It's particularly relevant when you're moving into uncertainty, and that's exactly what we're looking at the moment. There's other ways to think about diversification as well, as obviously within equity markets, but obviously across bonds and cash and other types of investments would be another obvious thing to think about. When we look across our global portfolios, we see pockets of opportunities everywhere. One of the areas we've liked in Europe for some time has been across European financials, and in fact, some European utilities as well. And then if we turn back to the US, where we see some of the better opportunities are actually across healthcare and industrials. So I just thought I'd mention some ideas that are outside of tech. There are lots of other ideas that sit outside of the sort of standard opportunities.
That is Bruce Apted there from State Street Global Advisors. That ends the podcast for this Tuesday, the 6th of May. Don't forget to give it a review or a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And click that subscribe button.
This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.